EAC to its meeting of May 8th? 9th. Well, I'm so far behind, I don't really know what day it is. A month out of the way of school, so. So what I'd like to do is start with our first agenda item, which is welcoming you, and then asking for a motion to approve the minutes of our last meeting, since you've all had a chance to read them. So that's a motion by Rich Hedges.
Second.
And a second by Will Din. Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Abstentions? Noes? Great. Passes unanimously. Thanks so much. Okay, our first subcommittee report is from Naomi for the Equity and Access Committee. Let me tell you about public comments. I just skip those if I don't have any cards up here. Not having any cards, then I feel that that job is done. But anybody in the audience who has not given me a card yet to public comment publicly on an item not on the agenda. Okay, no, great. Item number three then. The subcommittee report. Naomi?
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Equity and Access Subcommittee met this morning, and we had pretty much one major item, which was the proposed methodology for the 2013 TIP investment analysis. So that is something that this full committee saw a presentation on in 2010. And so then at this point, it was decided to bring this through our subcommittee to comment on. And there are two types of analysis being done, a population use-based analysis and a geographic use-based analysis. And given the data that's available, for instance, the Bay Area Travel Survey, unfortunately the data we have to use is still from 2000 because the new data won't be available when they need to run this analysis. But given the data that's available, the committee felt that the proposed analysis methodology was appropriate. And we were pleased with the results of the last analysis and are interested to see what the results of the new the upcoming analysis will be. And this full committee will be seeing that very soon. So then many of us participated in the equity working group, which had two major items. Actually, our agenda items got switched, and we talked about the One Bay Area grant update first, and then we talked about the Plan Bay Area draft preferred scenario equity analysis results. There will, of course, be an agenda item, a very important one here, on the draft preferred scenario. But just to acknowledge a couple of points, we were pleased that the analysis showed better results than we had seen from the alternative scenarios. And there was issues raised in both agenda items actually very much related to affordable housing and how do we work with cities and counties to really make that happen. There was a lot of different opinions and just a lot of concern about, as I said, how do we encourage these jurisdictions to provide affordable housing or to work on that as a process. But we did note at the end that even though these results were better than the alternative scenarios and that even though it seems to be that we're in a position where the results show that the new plans won't increase disparities, but that doesn't change the fact that on three of the five measures, there are still persistent disparities between these communities of concern and the regular communities. And there was a very sort of big question about maybe it's not good enough that we are just not increasing disparities. Maybe our plan should actually reduce some of these large disparities. So that's something I'm sure that we will have a lot more to say on. So that's my report. Is there anyone who was present at either of those meetings who would like to add anything to that? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Naomi. All right. Not having any questions on that, let us move to item five, please, with Denise Rodriguez, who will give us a summary report on the draft Clipper Title VI item. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Denise Rodriguez, Contract Compliance Manager here at MTC. And since I'm presenting two items, let me just ask the Chair, do you want me to, once I plan to present on the Clipper Title VI first, and then maybe open up to questions, and then move on to the general Title VI update? Okay. Okay. I'm here to present, again, two items. One is the presentation on Title VI analysis related to the Clipper program. So we'll get started with that. Title VI Civil Rights Act of 1964 states that no person in the U.S. shall be on the ground of race, color, or national origin be excluded from participation in or denied the benefits of or subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Based on that, with the Clipper program, we decided to take on and do Title VI analysis related to rollout of that program. In December of last year, myself and Clipper staff presented to your committee the draft Title VI analysis related to the Clipper analysis for AC Transit, BART, Caltrain, Golden Gate, and SFMTA. After the presentation of that report to your council, we initiated a 3-month-long community outreach effort and public comment period that included both focus groups and an open comment period. The open comment period concluded in December of last year. Also in the period since we last presented that draft report to your council, we revised Resolution 3866, updating the Fair Media Transition requirements to reflect some lessons learned, to add transition requirements for SamTrans and BTA, and revise some transition dates for some of the Fair Media projects. We also completed the Title VI analysis for SamTrans and BTA. The analysis for those agencies was posted approximately a month ago on April 2nd, and the public comment period for that analysis related to those two transit agencies closed last Wednesday. So the draft final report that's in the packet before you today includes information on the potential disparate impacts and MTC's proposed mitigations, which we've revised a bit, for AC Transit. The analysis now includes everyone, the first seven operators, which is AC Transit, BART, Caltrain, Golden Gate, SFMTA, SamTrans, and BTA. So, to just in general terms, we put together the initial draft report with the first five operators, engaged in a 3-month public outreach period, finalized the analysis for SamTrans and VTA, and really looked at the potential proposed mitigations that we originally proposed, and then reassessed those. And so forgive me, but I'm going to read from the memo so I don't forget anything, because it really does detail all of the mitigations that we're proposing and how they sort of morphed to get us to where we are today, because we really did take the public input seriously and changed our proposed mitigations based on that input. So based on input from received in focus groups, we are going to establish a process that enables youth and their guardians and parents and seniors to apply for Clipper cards by mail and or email. We're going to explore accepting additional forms of documentation that indicates a youth's age or other methods by which youths can prove their eligibility for the Youth Clipper Card. When we previously presented to your council, we had proposed a $3 card fee with a $2 minimum load, and the feedback we got in the focus groups really told us that that was just way too confusing. People didn't understand the minimum load and things like that. So what instead we're going to be moving to on September 1st of this year, what we're proposing is just a $3 fee. All of the benefits with the card, we feel we'll be all right with that. Based on public comment, we'll eliminate the $5 minimum load right now. There's no fee for the card, but there's a $5 minimum load, and there's a lot of confusion about that. People don't understand that it's really a minimum load. It's not a fee for the card. And that will also be effective September 1st, 2012. Based on a Title VI complaint we received, we're going to establish consistent $5 Clipper card and balance replacement fee for all customers at all locations. Right now, and I'll believe Clipper staff can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you go to the San Francisco Customer Service Center, you don't have to pay a $5 fee, but if you go to Walgreens, you do have to pay it. It's just very confusing, and so we're going to make it standard across the board, and so that will really help that. We're also going to, one of the potential disparate impacts we found were retail locations for the cards, and so we're going to actively monitor the overall Clipper network to ensure adequate geographic coverage. And as noted in the final draft report, there were several areas where we needed to add retail outlets, and we have done that already, and so that's noted in the draft report itself. But we're going to continue to note that, and as retailers maybe drop off, and make sure that we can keep that geographic coverage. We're also going to provide Clipper information at MTC-sponsored meetings, and we think that customer ongoing outreach and education will really be helpful. And based on the relationships that we've built through the implementation and public participation phases, we want to engage with community-based organizations through which the CBOs will then provide Clipper information to their constituents. So with that, I would like to ask for the council's input, or I'm here to answer any questions on the proposed mitigations and the final draft final report. Forgive me.
Nice. Lori, you have questions, and yes. I'll take questions at this point, so I'll take Lori and then Federico. Naomi, one second. Let me just get the list out there. No problem. Lori, Federico, Naomi. Okay, and then Benna. Thank you.
To what extent do you propose engaging with community-based organizations, and during this engagement, will the community-based organizations, in addition to just being responsible for getting those Clipper cards to residents and businesses in the areas, or maybe even having a location to where they can pick them up at, are you proposing any funding for these organizations to assist them with this?
I'm going to have to, Jake, I don't think we fully...
Didn't you repeat the question? No. First, do you want to take answers now, or should we do what we did last time, which is
just
them?
Yeah, we can. Just as a reminder, now going back to last September, there were a lot of questions that were given, and we Clipper staff put together a report of those answers. They should have been sent to you all, but I brought copies of that, and I think I brought enough copies for everyone in the group, as well as for members of the audience. So, but I think if we can try to answer something now, I think that would be.
First of all, Jake
Abbott
on MTC.
Jake, we can't record anything from the hinterlands. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Jacob Avedon, MTC Clipper staff. The short answer to your question is that the effort to engage community-based organizations is really at its infancy right now. We are just doing outreach to a few organizations in Santa Clara County to discuss with them how this might work. I don't yet have a clear answer as to whether they will expect compensation for the services that we discuss with them and request. What I do expect is that what we will ask of them will be very little. I mean, we are going to provide them with cards. We're going to provide them with information and ask them to make that available to their constituents. So it should be a fairly passive activity on their part. But if compensation becomes an issue, that's certainly something that we could explore.
And other arrangements with just as from a contract standpoint, when other arrangements with CBOs, we have offered some funding to them for assistance, with the SES-RTP outreach, we provided funding to CBOs. So that is something that we've done in the past.
Part B of my question, which is the last question, is how many organizations do you propose to engage? Would it be dependent on the population or the need for Clipper cards in the area, or have you assessed that yet?
No, we haven't. As I said earlier, this effort is really in its infancy right now. One of our staff members is contacting a number of organizations in Santa Clara County because she happens to have pre-existing relationships with those organizations. And based on what she learns from them and discusses with us here at MTC as well as with the transit agencies, we would, I guess, make some decisions about how many organizations to engage in each of the nine counties.
What's that staff person's name? And can I contact her later? Or?
Sure. Okay. Lisa Hale is her name. Lisa with a Y, L-Y-S-A, Hale. And her desk line is 817-5884.
Thank you.
Sure.
Is that a 408 area code?
Or? No, no.
We come from all over the place.
510. She's here at MTC.
All right, Lori, was that it?
Oh, yes.
Thank you. Federica?
Thank you. I have a few questions with regards to the materials that were presented to us today. But I would first like to begin with commending Clipper staff. I had occasion yesterday to meet with a group of blind individuals at UC Berkeley from the Bay Area, and the subject of Clipper came up. And I don't think there was a single individual voicing opinion that didn't have very positive comments to make. Regarding the use of the Clipper card over the prior system. Particularly for persons who are blind, disabled, it does present a great advancement in ease of use, a great advancement over the prior system. Most of the concerns that were expressed revolved around issues of accessing the card, reloading the card, and particularly for persons who are blind, knowing what's on the card, because obviously you can't see the readout, which I understand is on the a button on the turnstiles if you're at BART or at other locations. I did have some concerns in the report, and they may have been addressed within the overall report, and I apologize in advance if I missed them. But they basically revolve around the issue of the inclusion of how the analysis as it pertained to disparate impact for seniors and disabled individuals were conducted. I'm lost in the materials as to A, whether it was done, and B, if so, how it was done. That's number one. Number two, I'm concerned with regards to the selection of the four or five transit agencies that were identified, particularly as it pertains to my county, Contra Costa. AC Transit does a part of western Contra Costa County, but does not provide the bulk of services within my county. So those other providers, which are the ones with major problems of accessibility, County Connection, Westcat, Tri-Delta, weren't included at all. I have no idea what's happening with them when I read the report, if they were solicited for participation or not. I'm also concerned with regards to the issue of seniors. It appeared that the focus of the senior input was in San Francisco, which is great, highly urbanized area, concentrated, and so forth. But it missed the most highly concentrated single area of seniors in the entire Bay Area is in simply one location called Rossmore. 12,000 individuals, by definition seniors. And yet, as far as I could tell, no input whatsoever with regards from these individuals to the Clipper card issue, particularly with regards to, again, the issue of accessibility. But again, I close with commending Clipper staff, the designers. I've used it. That's how I get about, and I've had nothing but positive experiences with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Federico. Okay, I have Naomi. I think they're taking questions. I don't know if they're going
to
spend a lot of time.
We're trying to take notes on
answering them. Here's our challenge. As you know, we have an extremely important item that is going to a committee on Friday that they would like to seek our input on. We had 20 minutes scheduled for this. We now have 6 remaining. We haven't gotten to the balance of Denise's report, which means we haven't gotten to the balance of the questions for that. So if it is a question that needs to be asked about Clipper right now and can wait for an answer, I think I would, and the committee would greatly appreciate that. So.
Well, mine are all comments, and I'll try to go relatively quickly. First, I want to echo Fred on the ease of use. You can see my little blue strap around my neck, and I do have to say that for me, not having to mess with money on the bus or tickets, finding the agents to run my tickets for me has made my life much easier. So I do appreciate that a great deal. I've raised before concerns about the RTC Clipper card, which is the only means to access discount fares for people with disabilities. And I know that staff is working on that. My own agency hosted a regional meeting to go over the explanatory brochure that helps people figure out how to use that card. But I still maintain that as long as it is a separate system under Cordoba instead of being under Cubic with the rest of the cards, discount cards, that there are going to be disparities. And so I know that you have made some efforts to link those up more, and I encourage you to continue to follow that. For instance, I know that there have been software fixes so that now somebody who has an RTC Clipper card doesn't have to register it or won't have to register it as soon as they get it, which I know that we had to do before, which was a difference from somebody who was getting a senior or a youth disabled card. The last thing I wanted to raise was a community member named Sheila Gunn Cushman raised this idea to me, and that was basically about the eligibility certification to receive an RTC Clipper card, and that it is very focused on the medical paradigm right now. Though you can also receive one, eligibility for one, with having a DMV placard of some sort, which also has at its base a medical certification required. I'd like to point out that, for instance, for ADA paratransit, certification by many of our larger providers is now done on a more functional level rather than the straight medical model. So some alternative ideas might be accepting ADA paratransit certification as eligibility to receive a discount RTC card, because obviously you would love those people to be riding transit. And then also maybe receiving certification from a caseworker or a rehab counselor. So those are just a couple of ideas I wanted to throw out. Thank you.
Thank you, Naomi. Benna, and then Frank.
Really quickly, I'm kind of confused. You mentioned the having a $5 fee across all locations, but then you also said that the fee would be $3. So just wanted to clarify which one is which.
The $5 fee is for replacement transactions. The $3 fee is for an initial card acquisition.
So it would be cheaper to get a brand new card,
$3. If you lose it and you need both the card and your balance replaced, $5. The reason not to just get a new one would be so that you can get your balance transferred from the old card to the new card.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Frank?
Hi. My interest here has to do with overall Title VI update. One, I want to know what's the status of the first investigation of MTC in reference to equity and Title VI compliance. One, and secondly, I want to know what you guys are doing to work with the various charities that we have in the neighborhood in reference to community outreach. Are you making use of the churches when you're doing community outreach?
So, if I could quickly, it sounded like your first question was really dealing with the second item that we have not yet heard on MTC and Title VI. And your second question is the same question that Lori asked, in particular, how are we dealing with the CBOs in the future, which I think was answered. There's not a clear plan yet in place, but that will be forthcoming. And so I'm hoping that when it is forthcoming, Denise, you can just report back to us.
Yeah, I think we would include faith-based organizations along with community-based organizations.
Great, thank you. We have one last set of questions, I think.
Yes, and I was wondering if the draft appendices are available. I was interested in the one first, the SAMTRANS supplemental report. I think it's Appendix J.
That is available. It just wasn't posted online. Is that correct, Pam?
It is now.
Yeah, it is posted online. We just didn't put it in your packet. So
yeah, all of the appendices, with the exception of the public comment matrix, because that public comments for SAMTRANS and VTA just closed last Wednesday, and then we're going to incorporate the public comment that we received from you all into that matrix. So all of the other appendices are available.
Great.
And then as soon as that is finalized, we'll provide it to the council.
Thank you. And then my one other question is, in terms of what you're classifying as CBOs, does that also involve the public component of that in each county, like the human services agency or social services offices, like the one-stop centers? Because I know in our
like
county...
You're talking
like
social
services.
I don't know whether we were going to, but we will now.
Yeah. I really, in my county, they give out a lot of, the emergency bus passes and a lot of the stopgap kind of measures, so they'd be a perfect resource. This is a good Clipper population.
Can you outline, and it doesn't have to be now, you can just post it to Pam, how the outreach was done on the public, for the public input, because talking among the Santa Clara folks, we didn't get any notification of the VTA stuff. So.
Oh, okay. I believe it is outlined a bit in the staff report, but also Lisa Hale, who Jake referred to,
okay.
I'll have her provide that
Thank
information.
You.
Carlos. Seriously, you guys.
Thank you. Just one comment on, just in briefly looking at the report, talking about the retail network. This is not a question to be answered right now, but more the, it sounds like that Cubic has been retained to look at how to increase distribution to the unbanked in communities that we have a high population of unbanked. I just wanted to emphasize that something that the Clipper staff should continue to track that, because I see that as probably the biggest barrier to getting something where you have to have a to use it, you have to have a balance on it as opposed to using it having cash on hand when you have cash on hand. So it's something that as we move more into technology and go away from transactions with just paper money or with coins, that we make sure that the population that's unbanked is hopefully brought along, and I don't know what the answer is, but I just wanted to point that out. Thanks.
All right, Denise, I think we're ready for the second portion of your report.
Okay. Frank, this will answer your question. So this is just a general Title VI update, but most important, last September we had the FTA Title VI compliance review, and Amber Ontiveros of the FTA, along with Bonnie Graves, who is one of the FTA counsels, came and did the compliance review themselves. And we got the results of that compliance review on April 12th of last month. In summary, there were no deficiencies in 9 of the 14 areas, so there were 5 deficiencies found. As the report notes, 3 of those deficiencies MTC has already taken corrective action to clear, so those are done. The 2 things that remain are the equity analysis of fare and service changes related to Clipper, and I just gave you a summary of all of the work that we've been doing related to that before September and then since September, and so we think that we've taken substantial steps to already clear and take most of those corrective actions. The second area is in regards to our outreach to limit those with limited English proficiency and related to our language assistance plan. MTC adopted a language assistance plan last year, but the FTA is requesting that we basically augment, there's what they call a 4-factor analysis related to how you assist those in the LEP population. And so factors 2, 3, and 4, they're asking that we augment those. They're included currently in our plan. So we're going to our plans are, as per the memo, we're going to issue a request for qualification to get a consultant to help us to really do an in-depth look at that. We will, of course, have a public engagement along with that, as we did with our previous language assistance plan. So once, after we engage the consultant and we redo factors, we augment factors 2, 3, and 4, we'll revise our plan, post that online, and get public input. And then based on the input, either revise the plan again or move forward to formally adopt that revised language assistance plan. So those are the two areas. Some of the other things, and the full compliance report is in your packet, that they point out are things like staff training. We issued a mandatory training last month. Some other areas are notice to beneficiaries. As I mentioned, we've taken care of all of those things already. So we think, again, that we've made substantial steps, and we will continue to work with the FTA cooperatively to close out these two remaining areas. Any questions?
Lori?
Yes. Okay, real quick. Which populations are you targeting for the language assistance plan? Is it just the Hispanic population, or are there other populations?
Well, basically anyone who doesn't have English as their first language.
Uh-huh.
The way it's what they called a safe harbor. Uh-huh. It would be 5% or 1,000 persons.
Uh-huh.
And then there are, that's why you look at the four factors. And what are those factors, though? Because we live in such a diverse region that we would be translating for vital documents into so many languages,
okay.
It would be
okay.
Cumbersome. So we have to sort of look at the population as a whole. Right now, our language assistance plan includes Chinese and Spanish. And when I say Chinese, I think it's Mandarin and Cantonese.
Okay, good.
And so we'll look at that. And when we do factors 2, 3, and 4, we might find, for instance, that, say, Vietnamese or Tagalog or something might be something that we add.
Okay, good.
But, well, that's why we'll have to... When we augment factors 2, 3, and 4, that'll inform our decision.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, great. Thank you, Denise, for both of your reports.
Thank you.
And we look forward to seeing again that other follow-up Clipper information as it's or when it's developed. Thank you. Have a great day. All right. Our next item is item number 6. The Plan Bay Area draft preferred scenario. A number of big topics here: preferred land use scenario, jobs housing scenario, preferred transportation investment, and the RENA numbers. I don't know what order you're planning to go in, but if you would just introduce yourself and the specific topic you're introducing, then I think that would help us kind of stay on track with where you are. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for having us here. This is the first of a series of presentations that we're going to be my name is Miriam Chion with the Association of Bay Area Governments. I was saying this is the first of a series of presentations that we're going to be making on key components of Plan Bay Area. Plan Bay Area being the comprehensive regional task within which we have different components of different tasks. What we are presenting to you today, to clarify this a little bit, is the land use component, the housing component, the transportation component, and the performance targets that assess how Plan Bay Area is performing. I'll cover the land use component, which is the jobs housing connection strategy, and the housing component, which is the regional housing need allocation. And then my colleagues from MTC will cover the transportation investments and the performance targets. So we're going to start with, but before I get into the jobs housing connection strategy, just a few comments in terms of where we are right now. As you know, you all have been working really hard. We've been receiving a lot of input from you, from multiple stakeholders, from cities, from transit agencies, housing organizations, other regional agencies. And we're arriving, as I was saying, to a few key components that will be approved by the Metropolitan Transportation Commission and the Association of Bay Area Governments Board on May 17th, so next week on Thursday. And what we're sharing with you today is some highlights of those components that will be forward for approval. We have worked hard to try to integrate some of those components. As I was referring, the Plan Bay Area includes the land use, the transportation, the housing component. And we have been having meetings together, public workshops, to get joint meetings sponsored by MTC and ABAC to try to explore how we articulate that. This is the first sustainable community strategy, so it's the first time that we have a clear state mandate that organizes how we integrate the multiple tasks. So the first slide gives you a picture of how some of our attempts to integrate these components. PDAs, close to transit, close to services, commitment to fix it first to make the best use of our transportation infrastructure, a new funding, the One Bay Area grant program, that is closely linked to priority development areas, that is closely linked to housing needs, to housing production, specific transportation expansion projects that are aligned with the land use forecast. And again, overall, trying to address a healthy economy, a stronger economy, addressing our equity issues, and preserving our natural environment. And this is a summary of some of the input that we have been receiving. You've heard, I believe, plenty about some of this input, public workshops, surveys, meetings with planning directors, meeting with stakeholders, with business organizations, with equity groups, and a lot of correspondence that it will be posted on our website. So let me move now into the Jobs Housing Connection Strategy again. This is the land use component. This is the sustainable community strategy that explains how we can grow into the future over the long term, over the next 30 years, in a way that addresses some of our key goals. And the way I'm going to highlight some of the components here, since this is the Policy Advisory Council, we thought we'll start with the end, which is the policies, which is the section that we haven't really released yet. As we speak, we're refining some of the text. The report will be released on Friday. But what I'll do is I'll highlight some of the implementation actions linked to the overarching goals. As you all know, one of the big challenges for the region as we step out of the Great Recession is to assess how we create employment, how we recover from the recession, and how we do it in a way that supports our diverse economy, that supports diverse jobs, and that addresses the challenges of the region. So some of the actions that, some of the implementation actions, and again, this is just a highlight. This is a few examples of what will be included in the report that we'll be releasing on Friday. One of the components in the implementation actions is supporting in industries of opportunity. And what we call industries of opportunity are those employment sectors that are expected to perform well in the region. Within those, we have the knowledge-based sector that is the leading sector of our region, but we also have education and health. And within those industry sectors, we have a wealth of occupations. And what we'll be assessing and addressing, and this is linked to our HUD grant, is what are the efforts in terms of infrastructure, in terms of training and education that should be set in motion in order to support this diverse economy and this healthy economy. Another example of the actions is an inventory and prioritization of industrial land. As you all know, there are major changes in the way our industrial lands are being used. It's not our traditional heavy manufacturing. It's not even our traditional garment manufacturing. It's really a mix of businesses that includes some heavy manufacturing or heavy wholesale, concrete plants or bus yards or auto repair. But there's also a wide range of other businesses, the small businesses that either, you know, produce tofu or chocolates or coffee or bread, catering for school lunches, small repairs, small design shops. It's really a wide range of operations that require a little bit more of elbow room and access to a different land cost and more flexible space. And that resource, it's one of the actions that is included, that we take stock of those lands and what needs to be retained to support the diversity of the region. Another component is addressing some of the needs of some of our suburban communities that have been hit very hard in the last recession, that have endured conditions of poverty for over multiple decades. While we have a strong armature for the core employment centers in the region, and we think they are well positioned to absorb major employment, there's a challenge and there's a task to address in places like East Contra Costa or Solano, where the Silicon Valley model doesn't fit, where the major employment center doesn't fit, but where we need to identify the specific employment and business needs that can support the population, the residents that live in those communities and in those areas. And the last component is to pursue legislation or conversations with the state and federal government to identify the kind of infrastructure investments that are required to address this healthy economy. And the economic health of this region is not just important to us, the residents and the workers, but it's also important to the nation. We are an important component of the overall national economy, so we need to have a clear dialogue with the different levels of governments in terms of how the regions should be positioned. Goal number two, increase the amount, accessibility, affordability, and diversity of housing. As you all know, this has been a core of the specific efforts of this council, and it's one of the very challenging tasks that we have in front of us. The Jobs Housing Connection strategy links the production of housing to the type of employment we're producing, addresses the levels of affordability that will be required, increases the number of the share of multifamily housing that allows easier access to employment, transit, and services. So having all those components, we need to have a clear path of action in order to secure the pattern of growth that we're proposing. Some of the examples in this case, we have some specific actions in motion. The Transit-Oriented Affordable Housing Fund is already in place, and there are specific proposals to expand that fund so we can support specific affordable housing projects at key locations. As you know, this long-term strategy informs the regional housing need allocation, and we're hoping that we can work very closely with the local jurisdictions to ensure that the production of housing is accommodated within the priority development areas, close to transit, and at the levels of affordability that is required. The component about anti-displacement and planning in PDAs, as we have a lot of support and a lot of consensus on priority development areas and focusing our growth there, 80% of our growth will go into those areas. We've also heard very clear from you and other stakeholders that that poses a risk of displacement for the existing communities. These are communities that are established. Some of them are quite stable. Others can be impacted by the levels of public investments, and the task is not to exchange population, but to add to the existing communities, to strengthen the existing resources and the existing qualities. So we will need to spell out what are the strategies, policies, and regulations that can help us support the retention of our affordable housing, the retention of our communities for the access to their own social networks, to their own cultural resources that they have in place. And probably the most important component that we have been discussing already for a little while is the levels of state funding that will be required. We lost redevelopment agencies, and our cities are severely impacted by this loss. Our nonprofit affordable housing organizations are severely impacted. So part of the strategy is to engage in a very focused dialogue with the state government, with HCD, to identify and to figure out how we can secure the appropriate funding to produce the affordable housing that is needed. Without that, this strategy really would not have much traction on the ground. The third goal about strengthening a network of complete communities is not, as we have discussed already before, is not just a matter of plopping or distributing jobs and allocating housing. It's about the communities. It's about supporting the neighborhoods. It's about strengthening the neighborhoods. And part of the strategies at different levels will identify what we need to do in terms of school funding, school performance, school integration, access to parks. There's also a whole set of tasks that relate to resilience to natural disasters, and we have very specific efforts in motion. The Resilience Initiative, we have a lot of work on sea level rise, and we also have done a lot of work in terms of air quality, and we'll be coordinating with the other regional agencies in terms of how we align those other efforts with the Jobs Housing Connection strategy. And the last one, goal four, is protect the region's unique natural environment as well as the agricultural land. As you know, this focused growth allows us to place about 99% of the growth within the urban growth boundaries or areas that are already established as urban areas. So that means that very little is going into the open space, which is a very different trend from what we have experienced in prior decades. But there's a strong commitment from the region. There's a strong consensus on the retention of these precious resources, and this focused growth pattern allows us to support this strategy. Now, so what are the these strategies are geared towards enacting the pattern of growth that we have proposed. This is the levels of growth that we have shared with you before. There are no changes in the total regional growth. The changes have been in the distribution. The adjustments have been in the distribution. There have been some refinement in the analysis in response to some of your comments and questions. We have added a more refined analysis of the senior component, the multifamily housing, the single family housing. We have elaborated the linkage between jobs and housing in terms of occupation and wages, and the breakdown of some of the industry sectors by the types of jobs. In terms of the comments, this is just a summary of the comments that we received in terms of the distribution. So better alignment, concerns about too much housing in our unincorporated counties or communities with limited transit services, and a concern that suburban housing in suburban employment centers was too low. And these are some of our responses. We have concentrated the levels of growth from the March report to what you will see on Friday. There's a lot more growth that is focused in not just the three main cities, but the large and medium-sized cities that are in the core of the region. And we have, with that, we have been able to reduce a little bit further our greenhouse gas emissions to 10%. And we also have incorporated some of the specific input from the local jurisdictions from each individual city. This is just a quick snapshot. It really doesn't tell you a lot about the distribution, but you can see that the large counties are taking on higher growth in terms of housing, and the smaller counties are seeing a decline, and the same thing in terms of employment. Now, this is the housing component, and this is just a quick overview. If any of you is more interested in that, we'll be posting the material. I'll be happy to address that in the questions. But as you know, this is a state mandate. There's 70% that is based on sustainability. It is based basically on the distribution that we have in the jobs housing connection scenario, and 30% addresses some of the fair share factors. The total is much lower than what we had in the prior cycle, and that accounts for the major housing crisis that we just faced, major foreclosures and vacancies. So while the prior cycle was 214,000, this cycle is about 188,000 units for the whole region for the period, for the eight-year period, 2014-2022. This is just a summary of what we've heard and what were our responses. There were really no major changes in the methodology except for an adjustment for the small communities. So with that, we'll proceed with the transportation component of the Plan Bay Area. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Teresa Rommel. I'm with MTC's Policy Programming and Allocations Committee. Programming and Allocations Section. What I'm going to be covering is the feedback received on the proposed investment strategy, which we've been presenting over the last month and a half or so. As a little bit of background, the investment strategy basically consists of six investment strategies, and those strategies would dictate how we spend approximately $56 billion or so are what we've called trade-off revenues, which is basically a combination of discretionary revenues available to the region and countywide sales tax rollover funds as well. So next slide, thank you. So in regard to the fix-it-first strategy, which would continue the functional investment levels that were held in T2035 for local streets and roads and transit capital, which is essentially to maintain the existing conditions for the critical elements of our transportation assets at existing levels. Plus, the investment strategy would cover transit operating shortfalls and provide some investment in regional bridges. We heard the following comments, and that we should require Muni and BART to maintain their existing state of repair, and also that we should commit an additional $70 million or $2.7 billion over the course of the entire RTP per year to restore recent bus service cuts. In response to that, the proposed approach does allow for all operators to maintain the existing state of repair for critical assets, including Muni and BART. Secondly, we can't assume that all of the transit service cuts were made to productive routes and not supported by the transit operators. In many, if not most cases, the cuts were made to the least productive routes first. Third, the transit sustainability project recommendation to improve transit costs per service hour by 5% provides about $4.7 billion that was used to close transit operating needs for existing levels in the investment strategy. And lastly, a further $2.7 billion investment would require that we reduce funding for other investment strategies or require our transit operators to increase operating efficiencies. Therefore, we don't propose to make any changes to our recommendation on this strategy. On our One Bay Area grant strategy, what we heard was that we should be addressing resident displacement and encouraging affordable housing. We also heard that we were giving too much authority for investment decisions to the counties. Staff's response to these concerns and the proposed revision to the recommendation will be discussed in a separate agenda item related specifically to the One Bay Area grant policy proposals. Okay. Moving on. for our strategy of funding high-performing projects in the region, which included holding a New START, Small START reserve for future deliberation on which projects to apply those funds to. We heard suggestions that these funds should be set aside for North Bay and East Bay projects. In response, staff will present the policy language that's shown there on your screen for committee consideration. Essentially, the proposed policy would give first consideration for New START, Small START funds to projects in East and North Bay counties. However, all projects would be subject to performance and policy conformity evaluation, and selected projects would need to be established within Resolution 3434 or any regional transit expansion program that superseded it. For our investment strategy to squeeze more efficiency out of our existing system, particularly in regard to regional express lanes, feedback that we received was that we should integrate bus, van pools, and carpools with express lanes, analyze how low-income commuters can benefit from express lanes, and also eliminate the Interstate 80 to Yolo County and Interstate 580 to San Joaquin County segments. In response, MTC intends to consult with transit operators during the design and environmental process in order to integrate express bus, van pool, and carpools with express lanes. Secondly, we will learn more about the impact of express lanes on low-income and minority residents through the environmental processes. And the commission will be given plenty of opportunity to review the network scope and phasing in light of earlier segments of the network. Therefore, staff supports the inclusion of the entire network previously approved by MTC and the CTC. And the next slide is basically a summary of the currently approved network. We also received input that we should consider regional road pricing and other local parking pricing initiatives in our investment strategy. We had considered these previously during the target setting phase, but determined that they lack both support and regional authority. Also, local agencies establish these parking policies, so it's difficult to quantify the regional impacts of them. We do, however, include express lanes, which represent the regional road pricing strategy in the preferred scenario, and the proposed investment strategy does include SFMTA's downtown cordon pricing and Treasure Island pricing programs. Further, MTC will be providing funding to SFMTA for the San Francisco GO parking pricing initiative. Staff proposes that we consider pricing options in SES RTP EIR in order to better assess regional impacts. In summary, this slide compares the investment strategy for Plan Bay Area to T2035 in terms of functional categories. Overall, Plan Bay Area proposes to invest about 88% of available trade-off revenues in operations and maintenance, compared to about 81% in the T2035 RTP. So that's the investment strategy. I'll pass it on to Dave.
Good afternoon. Dave Vaughton with MTC's planning section. Now that we've shown you some of the key elements, both on the land use and transportation sides of the preferred scenario, we're going to take a look at the performance targets and the equity metrics that have been analyzed throughout the process. Of the 10 performance targets that were adopted by MTC and ABAG in January 2011, two were directly mandated by SB 375, and I'm referring to the CO2 reduction target and the adequate housing target. The preferred scenario meets both of these targets through a combination of land use and transportation policies. So first, we exceed our greenhouse gas emissions target by achieving a 17% reduction in total for our per capita GHG emissions by year 2035. And second, the preferred scenario provides housing for all of the expected growth to prevent increases in in-commuting. So let's examine these two targets in just a little bit more detail. As was presented to you last month, a number of things are incorporated into the preferred scenario. These include land use policy, transportation infrastructure, and the demographic and population shifts that occur in the future. Now, these elements of the plan get us a good deal of the way to the 15% target. It's about a 10% reduction of these things alone. But we need to close that gap to meet our 15% mandate. So therefore, we have provided funding for a number of climate policy initiatives to get us the rest of the way there. These strategies allow us to meet the target. So here's what we heard about the climate policy initiatives last month. There was some concern that the strategies focused a bit too heavily on improving auto efficiency instead of getting people out of their cars. There was some interest expressed to fund programs with greater benefits for low-income groups, and we heard that from this committee as well. Some folks advocated including additional bike or pedestrian programs, and then there was also a significant negative reaction towards the concept of a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. So in response to these concerns, we have developed a revised proposal for the climate policy initiatives. Our approach does continue to emphasize auto efficiency options because we need to rely on the most cost-effective means of getting ourselves to the GHG reduction target. You know, given that 4 out of 5 trips in year 2035 will still be occurring by car, we really do need to reduce the emissions from these vehicles to improve the CO2 emissions situation. This strategy of quote-unquote greening the fleet has been identified as by the Air Resources Board as a vital and effective approach towards emissions reduction. After the response to the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit, we've dropped that from our preferred alternative proposal, and we've added a commuter benefit ordinance initiative that would allow employees to pay for transit pass expenses using pre-tax dollars. And furthermore, on the issue of funding programs for low-income households, we want to note that the investment strategy does already include significant funding to support mobility of these groups through maintaining the existing road and transit system by Fix It First, by funding the Lifeline program, and by expanding the transit system to improve regional mobility. So here's a list of those policy initiatives in our preferred scenario. They include accelerating adoption of electric vehicles through charging stations and incentives, supporting the expansion of car sharing systems, particularly in the North and South Bay, incentivizing vanpool participation, developing a fee-based program, which would charge higher polluting vehicle owners a fee and lower polluting vehicles would receive a subsidy, moving forward with the smart driving strategy and implementing that commuter benefits ordinance. So this all totals 7% reduction in GHG emissions for a total of 17%, thus exceeding the GHG reduction target for Plan Bay Area. And now for a little bit more on the housing target, I'm going to invite Miriam back up here to just cover that in a bit more detail.
So with the next three slides, you don't have them in your packet. We have revised them. There was some error and some confusion, so please do not look at your handout. What we have summarized here in these new slides includes some of the input that we have received, and I think it might require another revision based on the input that we received from the equity group. But basically, this is how we address the housing target. Housing is related to the levels of employment growth. We are proposing 660,000 new units. If we add the 40,000 vacant units, that will allow us to accommodate 700,000 households. And the different income groups are stated there at 26, 17, 17, and 39%. And again, that is connecting the employment growth to the occupations, the wages and income, and the specific housing requirements for each of those groups. About 80% of the new housing will go into the priority development areas close to jobs and transit. And again, as we have discussed earlier, this level of growth, this level of housing production, this level of affordability relies on the appropriate set of strategies and investments at the appropriate locations. And that's going to be the conversations that we'll have over the next few months. What are the to ensure that the proposals in terms of the policies and the public funding really goes to address that strategy. We're a couple of references about the in-commute. If we compare the employed residents with jobs, what we're proposing for 2040 is quite aggressive, meaning that we're retaining the ratio of jobs to employed residents instead of increasing the ratio, which has been the trend in the past. We think that with the affordable housing production efforts and the transit investments, we can accommodate more of our workers within the region. And if you look at this, just illustrates the same point. The blue bars illustrates what we're expecting in the future compared to what we had in the past. And again, this is the blue is a combination of in commute and multiple job holders. Thank you.
Now let's take a look at the rest of those 10 performance targets. As you saw, we did meet both the mandated targets. We have mixed results for the rest of them. Starting with particulate matter, we do see significant reductions in premature mortality from PM2.5, and we're moving in the right direction with coarse particulates. Unfortunately, this is less due to Plan Bay Area and more due to recent regulations by the Air Resources Board. For heavy-duty trucks, which cause a lot of particulate matter emissions. And so we're going to see some great improvements on the health side thanks to those regulations. The other good news on particulate is that we did a look at the equity implications of that for care communities. Care communities are areas that the Air District has identified as being heavily impacted by particulates and their low-income communities throughout the region. And as we move forward, those areas are going to see greater reductions than non-care community areas thanks to these regulations. In addition, collisions are projected to increase rather than decrease due to the growth in VMT over the next several decades. And we do expect more individuals to be walking and biking, but not enough to meet our target of 15 minutes of activity per day. Looking at the remaining targets on the open space, we are very close to the goal of not impacting any of those greenfield areas, 99% target performance. For low-income households, there is a slight increase, particularly on the transportation side, of costs moving forward. For gross regional product, we are exceeding our target. So that represents greater growth over the next several decades than we have seen over the past few decades. On the remaining targets, we do see improvements in terms of more folks taking transit, less VMT per capita, thanks to all of our investments in walking, biking, and transit infrastructure. And on state of good repair, it's a mixed bag. Thanks to the OBAG program, there's a slight improvement in terms of local road maintenance, but not enough to help us meet our target. With highway maintenance, state funding cuts have worsened the situation there, and the road condition is expected to degrade. And on transit maintenance, there is the transit assets are expected to be used significantly after their useful lives. So there definitely is more demand for transit capital rehab than we can fund. Now, looking at the equity analysis measures, we looked at five metrics. Some of the folks on the equity working group may have heard about this earlier. The first was an affordability measure similar to the target, except it focused on the lowest quartile of folks making less than $30,000. Again, kind of a slight increase in income for housing and transportation. And in response to comments we heard with the alternative scenarios, the metric now includes housing subsidies, so it does include a more accurate look at the housing costs. For communities of concern, they are still have a greater risk of displacement due to the fact that a lot of this growth will be occurring in the urban core. VMT density measure, which represents the vehicle miles traveled per unit of developed land. It shows that there's a greater reduction in terms of vehicle miles and traveled and effectively traffic levels in close proximity to communities of concern, but those areas are still more heavily impacted than the rest of the region. And with regards to the travel times, both commute and non-commute, there's a slight increase for low-income and community-concerned residents, but still they're either at or below the travel times for the rest of the population. Now, these equity impacts are not due to a lack of funding or effort for the plan. We performed an analysis to look at where the $277 billion really goes and how much of it is going into communities of concern. There's approximately a 3-to-1 ratio, three times as much money being spent in communities of concern as opposed to outside of those communities. So that is definitely significant funding contribution to those areas. And a lot of that's coming from the realm of public transit, both in terms of keeping those transit services operating and also providing funding for expansions of transit. And so examples of some of the projects that allow us to provide more funding to those areas are the East Bay BRT, light rail expansion in East San Jose, and bus improvements in Hunters Point and Candlestick Point in San Francisco, just to name a few examples. Just a quick recap on the economic forecast. Again, we are forecasting significant growth by 2035, exceeding past economic trends, and we do surpass our target for this. Now, given the interest in jobs and the economy at this time, we are really continuing on a number of efforts to keep looking at the jobs and economic issues. The JPC is creating a regional economic strategy framework. MTC and ABAG are working on an economic impact report to understand how we can do even more detailed analysis in this vein in the future. And MTC and ABAG are relying on a HUD planning grant to investigate ways to create jobs and preserve affordable housing in the Bay Area. In conclusion, the preferred scenario will be considered for approval by the Commission and by the ABAG Executive Board next Thursday at a special joint meeting over at the Oakland Marriott. It will also be up for discussion at a joint planning committee meeting on Friday. It's important to emphasize this isn't the end of the process. We will be getting this EIR to evaluate other alternatives which have the potential to be considered for Plan Bay Area later this year. And then there'll be a final round of workshops in early 2013 with our agency is still on track with ABAG to adopt the plan and the EIR by April of 2013. So that's less than a year away. And with that, we'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, team. And before we actually take any questions on this, since we're kind of in report receiving mode, Craig, why don't you go ahead and go through the One Bay Area grant information at the same time, since it kind of flows in the same topic. Thank you.
Great. Hi, I'm Craig Goldblatt with the Programming and Allocation section. I'm here today to address some of the concerns that the Policy Advisory Council had with respect to local affordable housing production as part of the OBAG grant and the allocation of OBAG funds to the CMAs to make decisions versus directly to the individual jurisdiction. So there's a handout that was prepared, but just some small... Oh, it's up there. Great. So the recommended OBAG proposal, which we're going to go to the Joint Planning and ABAG Committee on Friday, is already available on the website. So for the details, I ask that you download that at your convenience, or we can send that out to you, and you can look at the details. But I'll just provide you a brief overview on how we're responding to your concerns. Generally, we're still recommending that OBAG be distributed at the county level, but we've included a number of features that we think will address your concerns, including being sure that there's a lot of transparency in what the congestion management agencies are doing and that the public and advocates can be involved in that process. And also addressing concerns just in terms of the transportation funding and project selection process. Transportation projects are often lumpy in a county, and some are ready to go and others aren't, given the short time frame of funding that we're considering, given the timelines of transportation projects. So to just go over some of the features of how we are supporting low and very low income housing. First of all, the RENA, OBAG will require that local jurisdictions adhere and meet to RENA targets. And we do that by making it a condition of any jurisdiction receiving funding that they need to have a housing element that meets those RENA numbers. And we have two steps. One would be that the current RENA in these jurisdictions, we have about over 70% that already comply with current RENA. For those that don't, in order for them to receive funding from the OBAG cycle that we're taking to the commission this month, they would have to have certification or they're not going to receive funding. We've also made an update to the proposals you saw last, where we've already put out a warning to all jurisdictions that for the next cycle after this first OBAG cycle, they're going to have to comply right out of the gate with the next RENA that's going to be adopted shortly, which is the 2014-22 series. In addition, the OBAG funding formula, the way the formula works is that that jurisdictions' performance in low-income and very low-income housing production, as well as taking on RENA, that comprises 25% of the formula. The other aspect of the grant program is that we're going to be reserving $40 million for both the PDA planning grant program as well as a TOD housing fund. And the planning program itself will be targeting PDAs and looking at some of the affordable housing displacement and production issues. We're going to also be putting some funding aside to help those jurisdictions that don't have the funding to do some of those activities. And we'll be able to have a group of planners go out and help those jurisdictions meet those goals. So some of the revisions also that we've made to OBAG is we've published, which you can see from looking at downloading the proposal at your leisure, we're showing in each county how the formula brings funding at the jurisdiction level to that county. So when it gets to the county level to decide how resources are going to be allocated among jurisdictions, those jurisdictions that that have made major contributions in housing, which is a major part of the formula, will be able to use that data and information to have a discussion about equity and being able to receive funding due to their performance in affordable housing. The other policy that we're going to require CMAs to develop a PDA investment and growth strategy, and that will be due January. There's a two-part process. It'll be due January 2013 initially. CMAs are going to have to work with jurisdictions with PDAs to analyze the progress on meeting housing production and inventory current policies towards RENA and low-income housing, and that they're going to have to work with cities to look at what the situation is in those PDAs and craft the appropriate housing policies as needed. That would be by January 2014, the short-term approach. Then the CMAs will have to embark on by a year later. They're going to have to put together some actual policy implementation measures to look at how these jurisdictions perform with respect to low-income housing production. And the key part about this is that we're going to be conditioning the next round of OBAG funding after this on the local progress towards meeting these housing production goals and policies looking at housing displacement. And so I think with that, I just wanted to point out, too, that the last piece that isn't in the PowerPoint is that we're going to actually have we're going to be reporting on the performance of OBAG at the county level, and we're going to be putting together a report back to the commission on what kind of decisions were made at the CMA level, what are the kind of projects they picked, how is their adherence to the RENA targets. We are also going to be requesting that the CMAs make presentations to the committees on the outcome of their PDA investment and growth strategy process. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thanks very much, Craig. And Miriam and Teresa, it might behoove us to have you all sit. Maybe you can take these mics over here so as people do have questions, we don't spend a lot of time up, down. So Listen very carefully, committee members. I want strictly clarifying questions on the information at this moment. I don't want comments on how you feel about something just quite yet. We will get there. Also, I have no comment cards from the community, so I suspect anybody out there who wants to address this issue would have put one in already. Okay, so for questions so far, I have Sandy and then Benna, Lori. And if you could turn your mics off until you're the speaker, that would be great. And then Kathleen, thank you. And I'll keep going. I'll keep going.
Hi, I have a question on slide 37, the slide that shows the where the investments have been made. And I wanted to know if you can spell out more how those, what's captured in that $277 billion. Like, for example, is the express lane network captured in that? Like, if an express lane goes through a community of concern, is that captured in here? Because I you know, this could be very misleading if the money that's going that's in here isn't actually benefiting the communities of concern. To put it as if it is very misleading. So I just wanted to know what is included in this.
So the way the analysis is done is for projects that go into a community of concern, they are included in that sum. So for example, for transit capital improvements, let's say we're buying buses for AC Transit. We look at the fraction of AC Transit service that is within communities of concern, and that amount is allocated to saying that it's part of that total for communities of concern.
Whether or not there's stops there, it would be counted?
Well, if there are routes going through that neighborhood with stops, then it's considered serving a community concern.
And my question about the express lane network?
Yeah, so express lanes that are within communities of concern, the capital costs for that are included as part of the community concern numbers, and the segments that are not within communities of concern are not. So the fraction of the network that's within communities of concern is counted, yes.
Okay, and my second question was related to the investment strategies. I noticed that it wasn't captured in the notes, but I, from my recollection from the last meeting, we had asked, or I had asked specifically, to have some more information about how, you know, some of the thinking behind how these strategies have been chosen and why others hadn't been chosen, in particular around subsidizing public transit usage for low-income users, and that wasn't addressed at all. So I wanted to hear more about that.
Sorry. Subsidizing low-income users of the transit system. I'm not sure if that question relates directly to the Lifeline program. I had heard a comment that, you know, where was the Lifeline program, and we did determine there is funding for the Lifeline program contained within the Fix It First investment strategy. So I don't know if that addresses your question.
It wasn't specifically related to the climate, the closing the gap strategies that we had asked for more information about how these specific strategies were chosen and why others weren't, and we were told we would have more information about that.
So I believe you're talking about the climate strategies, correct? Yes. Okay. So the climate, we did examine additional strategies beyond the ones that were chosen here. We looked at the cost effectiveness of CO2 reduction per dollar spent. So the reality is that while transit service is great for equity reasons and it improves travel times, it's not necessarily the most cost-effective way for us to get at CO2 reduction. And so what these strategies really focused on was how can we get to our target in the most cost-effective way possible. There's lots of money for transit service in other places in the plan that just it's not the most effective climate strategy.
Okay, thank you. Benna?
Just one quick clarifying question on OBAG. For slide 2, the second bullet, where you talk about what the funding formula rewards and provides incentives for low-income housing production, and that's on a countywide basis, right? So the county's share of the formula funds would increase based on how the individual jurisdictions do for low-income housing production. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. I have Lori.
Question under the Bay Area One Bay Area grant proposal as it pertains to certified housing elements. What about those communities who, you know, who don't have the funding to do their housing element right away? You're going to go with the existing one, even though it's maybe old and hasn't been updated. I think that's a challenge for most communities now.
We will be providing some resources. We're going to have a planning assistance program to be able to provide some assistance. But I think just as part of a community needing to have a general plan process in place, that is a very basic planning requirement. And in order for them to even be able to deliver transportation projects or go ahead with development in their community, that those resources we hope would be there. I don't know if you...
Maybe I could speak to that for just a second as well.
Could everybody else turn their lights off, please?
Okay. Can you hear me? All right.
Yeah.
Okay. You're raising a really important point. When I know that ABAG staff and MTC staff have been working with various jurisdictions on the whole issue of, well, we've got a lot of aspirational goals here. How are we going to fundamentally make them work? And so one of the set-asides in the OBAG program at the regional level is a significant investment in PDA planning assistance. And we will find out as we move forward working with each jurisdiction what the nature of that assistance might need to be. If it's as fundamental as you describe in some jurisdictions, we will have to help the CMA and the local jurisdiction figure out how to get it done.
Fair. Now I have a few other questions on the slide presentation. Slide number 7. Well, a few slides are here. But starting with slide number 7, actually slide number 8. Now I know that we have challenges in the city where I work and the city where I live in terms of open space and how developers are sometimes interested in building on open space. And so as it pertains to the goal of protecting the region's unique natural environment, are you saying that cities need to have, are you going to be have cities refer to the general plan and how much open space, what percentage of it? Are you looking, you know, if you're going to weigh this goal with whether or not a city or a community is actually meeting their goal for receiving funding under this strategy? I hope I made that clear.
Yeah, this is not a requirement for the cities, but is to work with the cities at two levels. Goal 4, which is about the large open space and the agricultural land, and goal 3, which is about the complete communities, that speaks more directly to what's the open space, what's the park, what's the needed park area for the existing population in a community. So to the extent that we can support your efforts to provide open space, recreational space for your community will be helping in terms of the planning, as Ann mentioned, through the planning of the priority development areas and additional funding that is set aside for open space.
Okay. Okay, good. That's a good answer. So on slide number 19, where you mentioned the Fix It First type of initiatives that you have or you're proposing. For the state of repair, I think I've mentioned several times how much revenue is actually going into the state of repair. I guess it's going to be continuing through 2040, maybe 2080, because it seems like every time you repair something, there's a need for repair somewhere else. So I'm not sure if we're looking at different innovative ways of bringing in transit services or different transit modes as opposed to continuing to repair the existing, you know, infrastructure, which has cost the state billions of dollars. and I'm not even sure if I even need an answer to this question now. But is the state of repair something that is where unions have been engaged to kind of push this effort, you know, so that there's more job opportunities or employment opportunities? Or, I mean, am I actually looking at this the wrong way? Or could there be even more opportunities for jobs outside of unions, and not that I don't support unions, but outside of unions, for newer innovative ideals that some of this funding could go towards.
Okay, well, when you said I don't want an answer to that, and
well,
then
that
you
was
asked
the first
question,
part of my question.
Okay.
The last part I do want to answer.
Yes, Anne, go ahead.
Okay, the why Fix It First is so expensive is because we have generations of investment in a very robust transit network and roadway network in the region. The opportunities for bringing down the cost of rehab is actually related to how well and how quickly you replace your system. If you spend a lot more money maintaining if you don't get on a decent replacement schedule. So that's what this is trying to do, is to try to actually reduce ongoing maintenance by having a good replaced system. It will not ever go away in from the respect as being the lion's share of the funding, mainly because of this, just the robustness of the system.
Or is there ever any way to reduce it to where you – so that you can start – looking at more innovative approaches? And then what, you can answer that with this question, because this is my last question. On slide number 22, this particular policy talks about, the response to comments and your recommendation to support the entire network of carpool lanes and express lanes. Well, I recently heard a news report that the carpool lanes have significantly decrease in terms of like the number of drivers that actually are crossing using carpool lanes now, and they're using more fast track lanes. And so, what's going to happen with? Yeah, did you hear?
Yeah, that's carpools using the bridges.
Right. So but the carpool lanes, they said, have reduced significantly, and so I don't know how any of this policy is really under this particular slide is really going to work for, for the percentage of decrease carpool drivers using the lane.
Part of it is
Rich.
I'm actually looking for an answer to that in terms of how MTC is addressing
about
that.
The express network. So I'm really not the one to answer that question specifically here. I mean, I'd like Andy Fremier or one of the staff there. The issue here has to do with the fact, and I think the concern was, should we include the entire system in there? At this point in time and where we are in the planning process for this specific program, that we are recommending that it be included. As it relates to maintenance, if that's what you're linking it to,
I'm linking it to your former answer to my question in terms of the use of it. If our whole goal is to reduce vehicle miles traveled, and by having people, carpool, and the percentage of carpool drivers have dropped because they're not using that lane, then why are we putting more funding towards this particular initiative?
Well, the HOT network is related to not only carpools, but using the capacity more effectively by allowing people to pay their way into using the lane. So that's how the connection is.
Okay, I'm not sure. Maybe we'll have to address that question or have that question answered maybe in future meetings, because I'm still not understanding your answer to that. Because the whole point of all of the lanes is for utilization. And if they said that percentage has dropped, then there's a problem somewhere. Thank you. You can answer for me later. Thank you.
Okay, I have Kathleen and then Rich and then myself.
And we're still on clarifying.
Correct.
Miriam, would you mind going back to the three slides that weren't included in our printouts? I just wasn't able to keep up with all of the information you were moving through on those three that went into the breakdown of future units.
So do you want me to go through the slides? So basically,
yeah,
we're saying... we're expecting 700,000 households that relate to the 1.1 million jobs. Mm-hmm. In order to accommodate those households, we need to produce 660,000 units added to the 40,000 vacant units, we can house the expected households. And the breakdown is what you see below there, 26% for very low, 17 for low, 17 for moderate, and 39% for moderate. So now, as I explained, the ability to produce and deliver that housing is linked to the strategies, to the planning support, to the funding from the state, to the coordination of regulations that will allow us to secure that level of housing production at the appropriate locations and levels of affordability. This had to do with the relationship between employed residents and jobs. In the past, as you can see, in 2000, the combination of in-commute and multiple jobs was 376,000. That was at the peak of our economic growth, our employment growth. Then it went down to 117,000 in 2010. We don't expect to go anywhere close to 2,000, but at the same time, we think that if we expect a healthy economy in the region, if we expect reasonable growth, that there will be additional workers coming from adjacent regions.
Thank you. That's the primary thing that I meant.
Thank you, Rich. Rich, now clarifying questions. Well, I know you wanted to educate us on Lori's question, but I want to make sure that
you're wasting time. You know that.
I do. Thank you, but I don't want to get into a back and forth. Thank you. Clarifying questions.
First of all, Rena, is there any money in any way we have put in? I can't recall a clawback for those organizations or cities or counties that do not follow through with what we expect them to do. Secondly, I'm just really not quite sure why we've abandoned, and I would like to have a reason why we haven't tried to educate folks more on the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. You can easily do a physics equation and show people that it's going to save, and it's the most efficient way to do it.
I can take the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit question. we have pointed out how significant the benefits are to that. We brought it up with our policymakers at the planning committee. There was very widespread disagreement towards that, pursuing that policy, and also some very major hurdles, including convincing CHP that this would be a good idea to get Caltrans on board. So there's a number of challenges, and we didn't have the support from policymakers, and generally the public reaction to this proposal was not particularly supportive either. So we decided we would focus on strategies that really get us to the GHG goal, and perhaps have a greater and broader base of support.
Could you clarify your Rena question exactly again?
I was concerned about the possibility of some of what we think people are going to do going sideways on us and being able to claw back the money that we've granted in one way or another.
Well, the way OBAG is structured is CMAs cannot provide funding to a jurisdiction that is not compliant with Rena with respect to their general plan housing element. So there's nothing built in the proposal that would let them get around that.
Okay, good.
That's good. Thank you. And is that it? Perfect. Myself and then Randy. If you could go to slide 19, Dave, thank you. And if I can turn to slide 19. So I want to clarify the question here, because when I read it on my computer, I thought I misunderstood it. The second bullet under the response to comments, assertion that all transit cuts in recent years were on productive routes not supported by transit operators. What we're really saying in that bullet is the transit operators cut unproductive routes, Why don't we say that then? Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understood that. And then on the bottom of page, or on slide 22, and it probably rolls over to slide 24, but we can stay on 22. I thought at the last meeting we heard a lot of concerns being raised about having the current HOV lanes all become a pay-for-price, a pay-for-use by the express lane pricing. And really, maybe it's more of a concern of the committee that we all have. I think the question was asked, can these HOV lanes eventually become pay lanes only? And I thought the answer was yes, they could. And I thought the committee reeled back and said, we don't know if we want those to be pay lanes only eventually. So it's really a committee question. They're mostly nodding. Well, nobody's disagreeing. Let me put that spin on it. And so I think that just needs to be clarified, perhaps. But although, Benna.
I think we talked about road pricing in general as a concept, and this is one step towards getting more road pricing. So I think it's worth some discussion.
Okay. Maybe I could just clarify one thing as well. The very last bullet there on that slide, one of the issues, actually it's not this slide, I'm sorry, it was a different one, where the pricing question came up. What we are proposing, and maybe just to recap a little bit, what we're doing this next week is to hopefully get approval for a preferred scenario. And that preferred scenario will be evaluated in an environmental impact review process. And we have to add a couple of other alternatives to be reviewed as well. And our suggestion on the pricing question is to have one of the alternatives in the EIR focus more on the pricing question so that we can see what it does, but not forward it yet as a preferred scenario simply because of the feasibility questions that we quite frankly are getting a lot of feedback about that. So I didn't want to lose that. I know there's a lot of information for you today, but that's our suggestion to the commission.
Thank you. Randy has the last question, I think, and then we'll start a list for comments.
Thank you. This is to follow up on Kathleen's question because I really wasn't clear on the numbers there. And do those reflect the numbers of affordable housing units broken down by type and income based on the new residents, or does it take into account the existing deficiencies in affordable housing? That's question number one.
The numbers that were shown on that slide for housing target, it's the total by 2040. But if you want the disaggregation, we could, we will include that. It will be included in the report. Now, the second component of your question is, if I understand correctly, when we address affordable housing, do we address the challenges that exist today? To the extent that the analysis assess number of households, number of people per household and number of households per housing unit, we are addressing that in the overall analysis. But the quality of the housing conditions, the conditions of the building are not analyzed.
Thank you. That part captured it. And then that leads to the follow-up to Rich's question. The question that I heard not quite answered was, do we have clawback opportunities, not if they have a plan in place, but if they don't ever implement their plan?
Maybe I could ask a question back. Clawback, you mean would money be taken back?
Yeah.
Okay. The recommendation for staff, and you guys can fill us in, you know, if you think otherwise, but our recommendation is to allow the first cycle of funding to have certain hurdles be established in terms of moving everybody in the right direction. If anyone fails to meet the requirements that are in OBAG, it would apply to the next round of funding, and we're recommending very strongly to the commission that the linkage to affordable housing production be made and basically committed to as we move forward on this preferred scenario and for this round of OBAG. Does that make sense? We're not recommending a clawback or a returning of funds. Where we are putting most of our attention is to the process that the CMAs will use working with their local jurisdictions to comply with the requirements and eligibility for the OBAG funds. And we will have a report back to the commission midway through in 2 years to see how we're doing.
All right, we're on to comments, and I have Aegon first, then Rich, then Carlos.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try to go quickly because, unfortunately, I have to run out of here. On the ABAC thing, thank you, Miriam, for presenting that. I'll maybe reserve my comments since we're focused more on MTC. I'd say that the main one is we still really look forward to the specific set of policies so we can evaluate them more clearly. I think there's a lot in there. I would just encourage you to write policies that might be actions that local governments should take, but that ABAG can model for the region. For example, drafting urban growth boundaries, identify where those should be, figuring out where densities are sufficiently low and should be increased, write draft zoning ordinance for industrial land preservation, whatever it happens to be, but make them specific, but don't shy away from ones that local, but to push local governments to do, to change things. On the MTC things, three categories. One, fund high performers, slide 21. I think this one is the staff recommendation I respectfully disagree with. I think this is not a dangerous precedent, so to say. I don't know if it is a precedent at all, but we as a region should put forward the best and most competitive projects to the FTA. We shouldn't at this point say, well, first we'll put them from this part of the region, not this part of the region, even though we have some criteria in there when they go forward. And so I don't know if my colleagues agree with me on this, but I strongly disagree with the proposed language for committee consideration, and that we should, for the new starts, reserve, put forward the best projects that score the best generally, and not say that they should first come from certain parts of the region, not others. Can I at this point put that into a motion?
You could.
I'd like to put that into a motion that the Policy Advisory Council disagrees with staff's proposal to add this specific language for committee consideration, and that we should put forward the best projects regionally and not divide them up geographically at this point.
So it looks like there's a second from Randy.
I want to comment on that, if I can.
I figured by the light being turned on.
Okay.
Lori?
I thought this was just for discussion and input. The action is just a discussion and input item.
Well,
so why are we making?
We asked our clarifying questions. Now we're discussing the whole information that's being brought to us. Staff has asked us to give them feedback on some of the recommendations. This slide 21 is a specific policy recommendation they put language forward to. One of your fellow committee members says he doesn't like it, so he made a motion. It got seconded, so now we're going to debate that motion.
But why do we have to put it? Why do we have to put it in a motion format? Can you just give it to staff and then have staff respond to it? Do we really need to do a motion on this?
Well, he already did, and that's what we're debating now. So you can weigh in now on the motion, but he already made the motion. He can't rescind it.
Okay.
Unless a seconder wants to, and I have a feeling not. So do you want to weigh in on the motion?
I'm not quite sure of the... Okay, I'm not quite... Egon, can you just explain to me a little bit more clear? I need a clarifying question.
So two things. One, the reason I put into a motion, my understanding is this is going to a joint committee this week. This is our chance to weigh in and provide specific feedback. This is not a kind of staff back and forth issue. It's going forward or it's not.
Okay.
And the reason I'm proposing to disagree with it is that it puts us potentially in a less competitive position with the federal government if this ends up encouraging us as a region to put forward not our best project.
Okay.
And that's all that
all
we
right.
should.
And
okay.
Okay. So I have Rich, I have Sandy, and then Carlos on this motion.
Just for a quick question for staff and you, I'm trying to remember the reason for this, and I thought it was an equity reason. Because I'm from San Mateo, so I would normally be in favor of the motion, but I don't want to destroy any equity efforts we're trying.
Okay. Kathleen?
Could I get a
answer?
Yes. The issue at hand for the commission was that the commitment of the other funding that in Plan Bay Area towards projects in San Francisco and Santa Clara County, and who am I missing, in San Mateo, that the East and North Bay counties are kind of off the list for now, and therefore this was a request by the commission that staff come up with language to deal with the equity question.
So, okay, it's an equity issue.
It's a geographic equity.
Right. Okay. Sandy?
I have the same question.
Okay. Carlos?
Mine was similar, but I'll ask it anyway just because I want to be sure. Because we've got a lot of information here, and this is, we were talking about the RENA allocation. This doesn't have to do with how the distribution, because it doesn't involve Santa Clara and San Francisco. Okay, thanks.
Federico, I'll get you in a second. Linda?
I think I'm going to be voting against this because the need for putting in a lot of the housing is going to be in some of these areas, and they have been neglected as far as transportation dollars. So I think I would like to leave that in there as a reminder that we need to be looking at both the North Bay and East Bay equally, which we have not in the past.
Yeah.
Federico?
I, too, oppose Elon's motion. As a resident of the East Bay for many decades, I have personally seen and experienced my section of the county, or the Bay Area, being overlooked. And I believe that the motion as presented is inappropriate and continues to a trend of disadvantaging our areas and our regions that have been overlooked so long. I would not be opposed to further consideration and debate, but for the purposes of today, I will be voting no.
Gerald?
To the issue of changing this or getting rid of it, yeah, I'm opposed to it unless you can tell me what is shovel-ready in San Francisco, San Mateo, or Santa Clara County that you're so positively ready to put all your...
Can I respond? No.
Yeah. Okay. I got Benna and then Randy.
I mean, I know that the New Starts program is a very competitive program, and I think Aegon is right that we need to, as a region, move forward our most competitive projects. And I think maybe some of this is worked out in the details, so these projects will be evaluated on a region-wide basis according to performance targets in Plan Bay Area. So I imagine that credit for having existing and future residents should also be a part of that performance criteria. But we should talk as a region about, you know, how, what kind of criteria we want to establish that is beyond just geographic location.
Randy?
And just to piggyback on that, I think that this actually does the exact opposite of what I'm hearing the objections are, which the way this is worded actually pits people within the region against each other rather than as a region presenting our best projects is how I read it. And that's why I'm supporting the motion.
Any other comments? All right. All those in favor of Aegon's motion, which is to put forth our best projects rather than projects in a specific area, please raise their hands and keep them up. So we have in favor Benna, Randy, Aegon, Dolly. All those opposed to Aegon's motion, raise your hands. Is it fair to say the rest of the committee? Okay, any abstentions? Okay, the rest of the committee, that vote is 4-12. That motion fails. And it's your comments.
So two other very quick comments. One on pricing. I appreciate what Anne, you explained about that, and I think that's important. Just the quick comment is the entire RTP seems very clearly to scream out the need for pricing, particularly as you address the need for cost-effective ways to reduce GHG. And they are what you pointed out, Dave, in your presentation, we're failing to meet targets 10B and 10C. So if it's not going to be in the preferred now, being in the EIR gives a chance to include it in the future, is my understanding. It doesn't preclude it. Finally, on the GHG gap, my sense is it's still too focused on vehicles, but I really encourage that, I am encouraged that staff are including the price per ton of GHG reduced as a metric, and strongly encourage that to be kind of one of the dominant criteria when deciding how to include something. I mean, if cost effectiveness is a primary metric of thinking about close the GHG gap, then we should be using that, and that should be maybe added to the presenting materials. So thank you very much, and my apologies for having to run out now.
Okay, on the comments list, I have Rich.
The overall presentation is that I support the freeway initiative. I think there's some corollaries to it that we could go into, but I think we have a need for funds. That's one way to mine money from people who can afford to pay it. I really considered the equity situation, and based on information we have, I don't think it will impact communities of concern because folks usually drive alone because of the type of employment they have. And I think we could also use this if we decided to bite the bullet and go to 55-mile-an-hour speed limit by allowing people to go a little faster in the so-called HOT lanes, which would encourage use. We could follow the procedures that LA does, and you can't just jump in and out of them at any time. They even separate them by K-rail. So it could be done very safely and go faster in just one or two lanes. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, thank you, Rich. Next I have Carlos.
Thank you. Appreciate all the staff information that was given to us. That's a lot. Was a lot to take in, and I just had a couple of comments that I remember at this point. One is actually a comment that was made earlier in the regional equity working group. Just a feeling of, in terms of some of the preferred scenario and how it met the targets that you know, from an equity standpoint, there's disappointment in that some of the targets went the wrong way, and particularly around the housing, some of the housing issues, and I, unfortunately, I'm blanking out what slide that is right now, but 35, and so I think we really appreciate what the staff has done, though, in terms of effort to listen to our input. And it always comes down to some of the veterans from previous equity analyses. It seems like any time that we have we put it through a model, the model always seems to show very little impact on you know, ideas and strategies that I think good strategies that staff come up with input from community stakeholders. So, like I said, I just use it more as a comment, just that it's, once again, kind of a little bit disappointing to see that the needle barely moves on some of these things, or in some cases actually go a little negative, or, you know, less positive, or, you know, not as impacting in a positive way. The second comment I wanted to make was around the OBAG, the One Bay Area Grant. Just something that we also talked about earlier today, that I feel, and also speaking from the affordable housing industry, there's a lot of concern at this point about how the congestion management agencies will be adapting this whole new language of housing and RENA, and something that I don't believe that the CMAs deal with a lot. And so I'm hopeful that ABAG and MTC will help I heard a lot of good things today about keeping tracking and seeing how well the CMAs do on terms of making sure that housing elements are met and targets are met and things like that. And I hope that and that the MTC and ABAG staff will potentially think about maybe even having kind of 101s for these CMAs to be sure that they get the different world of housing and affordable housing in particular, but as well just housing development. And it's something that there's concern from the housing industry right now about that, about because it's kind of introducing something into a transportation funding process. This housing is something a little different. I think it's wonderful and it should be done. And so just hope that the two agencies will be able to shepherd it through. Thanks.
Kathleen? And then Benna?
I would just quickly echo Carlos's comments that some of what we discussed this morning in Regional Equity Working Group with, on several of the equity indicators, this scenario is not moving us in the right direction. And we've stated that as one of our goals. So the idea being that there's further that we need to push this to make it work. I would also very strongly second support for further examination of the 55 mile an hour work. One of the requests I made last month was that as we did the cost effectiveness analysis, that we see the cost per ton of GHG reduced from this initiative, and we don't see that here in the current presentation. Because just like the more full expanded road pricing alternatives that you say we can explore in the EIR, I think it's worthwhile in terms of being good stewards of public funds to look at the 55 mile an hour speed limit. I understand that there's major political feasibility, lack of political will, resistance from Caltrans, CHP. They're state agencies. We're implementing state legislation. The Strategic Growth Council is supposed to be working to get everybody on board. If we're trying to do a policy that will help implement their legislation, they need to get their state agencies on board to help us meet that goal. And I really, really, I don't have it in a motion, but I would really encourage this council to strongly put that word forth to the commission for Friday's meeting.
May I take the prerogative for a second, Benna? If I understood you correctly, Kathleen, you'd like to have something like, in order to evaluate the full impact of GHG reductions, this committee encourages MTC to evaluate the GHG reductions brought on by a 55-mile max.
So moved.
In the EIR? Because I was trying to figure, but was that what I heard? Okay, so was that a motion, though?
I just made the motion, if I can get a
second. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Rich made it. Marshall seconded. Okay. All right. So now we're taking a break from the actual discussion of the item and coming to discussing the motion. Any other comments on that motion? Marshall. Sandy, comment on the motion?
Well, I'm definitely in support of it. I mean, in addition to it benefiting greenhouse gas reductions, it has a lot of public health benefits, and I think that there's cost benefits there as well that I think should be considered. So I'm very much in support of it.
The reason I made the motion was very simply you can actually do a physical science calculation on velocity and use of energy that shows that it's more efficient, and it's also the cheapest way to lower greenhouse gases.
Any other comments on the motion? All right. All those in favor say aye. Okay, any no's? One no and is that a no or no? Okay, two no's. Any abstentions? One abstention. So we'll get you the count in a second. All right, and was that it, Kathleen? Or did you want to make another motion on something else since you were doing such a...
The only other component... Oh, so sorry. Really would just be the idea that when the CMAs do have to present their PDA growth strat and investment strategy, to me, at this point, it's not clear what they're coming to present. Like, I understand it's sort of an interim checkup, sort of how are things going, but it seems like so many of these great policies that staff have developed over the last year, year and a half, have then somewhat gotten walked back and weakened a bit. So I would encourage some sort of clear expectation for that presentation of what they'll be expected to share with you and or what recourse or sort of mid-course correction MTC will have the discretion to take at that presentation.
Okay, just wanted to announce that vote. Sorry, we knew it passed, but it was 12-1. Benna, you're on the docket.
Just to follow up on what Kathleen just said, also on OBAG and the PDA growth strategy, perhaps one idea is to ask jurisdictions to analyze and present the barriers that they have to building housing and also to building denser jobs as well, and then to address the policies that they will enact or have enacted to address those barriers. We know there's a lot of things that jurisdictions do, like having height limits, having particular parking requirements, et cetera, that really hinder the ability to build both housing and dense jobs. And so that would be a great step forward, is to just have that in public, listed all those different barriers, and then also how they will address those. Thanks.
And just for further clarification, when I said 12-1, 12 yeses, 2 noes, 1 abstention. Not that there were only 13 people voting. And with that, we have Gerald. Oh, was that it? Okay. Yeah. I operate with as few words as possible with high schoolers during the day, and I'm sorry I slipped into that mode. Any other comments now on the entire program before us? Item 6. Randy.
I just want to kind of piggyback on what Benna just said and also go back to the affordability component in people's general plans, because my experience has been we're going to be having a competitive situation based on the fact that people have a general plan that they've adopted, but adopting and implementing are two different words. Adopting's awesomely easy to do. Implementing, I would like to see triggers, game plans, whatever, some idea of how they actually plan to implement the affordable housing component in their general plan. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Kathleen.
I know that a lot of the freeway performance initiative at this point is pretty project specific. But if it comes down to, I know we're dealing with a net zero kind of closed universe amount of money here, but I could almost see some of the freeway performance initiative funds being used for automatic enforcement, just following up on some of that 55-mile-an-hour speed limit change. So I know that we get into the trade-offs conversation of if you want this, you don't get that. So I would suggest looking into use of FPI for some automatic enforcement.
Okay. Item 6 has really been the culmination of hours and hours and hours of work on both MTC and ABEG staff, as well as this committee's discussion, proposals, more discussion, more proposals. And so I appreciate, first of all, that my colleagues here on the committee have really taken this job seriously, and I think we're handing you, MTC and ABEG staff, some really good recommendations. We appreciate your patience and your ability to explore other avenues that maybe you were somewhat interested in helping to address our questions. So thank you on behalf of this committee, and we know you'll keep us posted. All right. We committee members are now on to item 7. Pam.
All right. Well, hopefully you have at your chairs our annual report, which is out. My coworker Joe Curley would kill me if I didn't mention that. So there's a lot of great stuff in here. Some really incredible pictures captured of the workers that are actually doing the work on our projects out there. So it's a good read this time around. I enjoy it. Your pictures isn't your. Oh, there would be a reason for that, I suppose. Okay, so, yikes. save the date on something that Aegon brought forth to my attention, the fact that we have parking workshops that are coming up. We've talked a little bit about parking policies, about pricing policies, but also on the parking side, I'm sure you know, in terms of supporting smart growth, parking policies are really important. So there are some workshops that are coming up scheduled for June 11th in San Jose, June 12th here at the Metro Center, and June 13th in Walnut Creek. And we will get you more information as we actually have the locations and times of those, so stay tuned for that. And, oh, vacancy recruitment closes today for the four vacancies on this council. So if you know of someone who was going to be submitting an application, they have till midnight tonight to get that in. The online application will stay up through that time, so please encourage them. We have probably around 30 applicants so far, so we're doing fairly well on that. And there's a handout at your chair also that I think I'll let Rich speak to under council member items. And with that, I'm done.
Well, coincidentally, our next item on the agenda happens to be council member reports. So, Rich?
I left a copy of two articles from San Francisco Business publication about housing that's being developed. It's the first steps in Bay Meadows, and also they're moving back to do housing near the Pleasanton BART station. That's a very good sign. I don't know whether you're aware, but Mid-Peninsula's cooking. An endangered species, the construction crane is now back in from the endangered species Gilead's building. So the economy's coming back. I think we can expect some housing uptick. And at least our housing is 15% in Bay Meadows. And we have another 1,600 units that keeps cooking within a half a mile of one another that'll be built.
15% affordable. Okay. Naomi.
Thank you. I just wanted to note that on last Tuesday, I was able to go with Pam and Sri Srinivan to the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund anniversary celebration and fundraiser at the Ed Roberts campus. I was a guest of the MTC, which was very nice. And we had some really great speakers about basically the law was 504, which basically predated the ADA, and sort of the historical events around that, including a 26-day sit-in in the San Francisco state government building to get that law implemented, essentially. So it was very interesting, and it was nice to be in the center. So I just wanted to think. It was the early 70s. I think like 73 or 74. Yeah, 74, 75. So it was a very nice event.
Okay. Marshall?
All I have to do is find the right button for the microphone. But I had my regular monthly attendance at the Paratransit Coordinating Council meeting in San Mateo County yesterday. I try to get to that every month. They do an excellent job. Beautiful, detailed reports of performance. But one unique thing that came out yesterday, they're planning on organizing an outreach program to this community that is their community, the disabled and disadvantaged community that use paratransit, to try to increase people's awareness of paratransit and transit in general. They're planning doing this in the form of an improved special version or special edition of their newsletter. I'll try to get copies of that to distribute to you folks as soon as it's available. But I would encourage you to, if you can, look up San Mateo County's PCC on their county website and come to one of their meetings. It's a very refreshing experience to see SamTrans, the MV Transit people, the various people who are users, consumers, all cooperating, collaborating, working together without any real friction at all. One of the SamTrans staff was there to make a presentation yesterday. She said she used to be the staff liaison to paratransit, and after listening to the meeting, she said one of the things she wanted to do was congratulate everybody there for getting along together so well compared to what she had experienced years before.
Thank you. The only other event that I want to mention, Will, would you like to go first?
Yeah, I just wanted to share with the panel, I mean with the my fellow council members, I served on the San Francisco Lifeline Evaluation Panel on it, and the it was through the Congestion Management Agency there on it, and also participated in the Transit Effectiveness Project coming through the Chinatown Core area to speed up the Muni speed, to increase it so that it can approach 8 miles an hour, 8 miles an hour, mind you, on it. So it was something that was meaningful to the community. They understood that some of the improvements they're trying to present, and the difference is you can gain 35 seconds in one stop or 20 seconds another, and it helps along the way. So that was very interesting for us.
And I'm sorry I don't have the exact dates and venues on this, but June 4th and June 3rd as well, Gil Peñalosa, who's the former director of Parks and Rec for Bogota, Colombia, which is sort of is world-renowned for their BART rapid or bus rapid transit and sort of bringing back bicycling and walking, also as an equity issue, is going to be in the Bay Area. He's being brought by the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition and will also be doing some events on the peninsula. June 4th. So I will send out more details through Pam, but he's just really inspirational. So it's not location specific, and he's just a great speaker. So I'll send the information out through Pam, but would invite everybody.
Thanks. And I just want to thank you, Ben, on behalf of SVLG for hosting the great lunch that some people here were in attendance for the San Jose groundbreaking. And then we were followed by a fabulous ceremony with Senator Dianne Feinstein and former DOT Department of Commerce Congressman and San Jose Mayor Norman Y. Mineta, who has an airport named after him. And it was just a really fabulous event and something the South Bay is very much looking forward to. So with all this good cheer and Carlos's last words.
Just wanted to know if you're going to have new business.
Yes, I am going to have new business. With all this good cheer, I was going to move on to the next item, new business, of course. Carlos.
Real quickly, just following up on Pam's report, I'd like to see if we could have a future agenda item on the high school internship program, because it's in the report. And that, usually there's like a kickoff where MTC advisory council members are invited to attend, and I don't know when that's planned yet. But anyway, I know it's probably coming because summer vacation's coming.
Well, and there has been, actually, this was the college internship program that was mentioned in your staff report, but you're right, there has been so much stuff on your agenda that we have not agendized that for you at this point. I do know also that staff has been really busy because we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 800 applicants this time, which is close to three times as many. I mean, it just keeps growing. So the program is definitely alive and well. And at the very least, we can at least get you a report on the hiring and get you an invitation to the closing ceremony, which is a bit more inspirational, just to hear how the kids interacted, what they learned. It's the better, I think, of the two. The opening ceremony, everyone's kind of wide-eyed and scared. And so when they come back at the end of the program and tell you, you know, what they learned and how much they didn't realize was associated with, when you say this word, transportation, that's what's really very cool about the program. So,
Dolores?
Yeah. How many students have college? Oh, I turned off. Sorry. Marshall, well, I'm having the same problem. How many high school and how many college students do you have as interns?
Well, you should know there are two completely different programs. The college internship program is hiring college internships for MTC, for employment at MTC. The high school internship program, designed as a result of the former MCAC, is to expose high school students around the ninth counties to the transportation arena. So they could be working for the county, a city, a CMA, a transit agency. And some of those agencies do put up matching funds in order to get interns. So, yeah, exactly. We never know. It depends on the applicants that come in, who's willing to sort of match the funds if there isn't enough funds at the main level, and what the agencies want. So stay tuned.
Great. Any other new business to come before the committee? All right. Well, then this meeting is adjourned. Have a great rest of the day.